Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public service professors, and most importantly, plain-speak Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Peter Hanna, Josh Cantrow, and John Stewart, and later on, Jonathan Morgan will join us in our program to come to you from our base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Toll-free lines open, 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you want to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. You want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, both radio and television, every single week at beyondthebeltway.com. And if you miss the show on Sunday night, it's always there. You can always find it. So the guests who will be speaking to you for the next couple of hours, they'll be able to play this back for their grandchildren in the next 15, 20 years. We have so much to discuss tonight. We'll continue our discussion of the school shooting in Florida, the reaction to that shooting by the President of the United States in a very emotional session at the White House. It caused some controversy, as the President frequently does with his suggestion to arm teachers. But there was a listening session. There's been a lot of reaction to what happened in Florida. The most notable is just the continued incompetence of the local police authorities, primarily the sheriff's office, to deal with it in advance. Over 39 instances where the shooter should have been stopped by someone somewhere in the government sector, and all the red signals were missed, all the red flags, every single one of them was missed. So we're going to talk about that. But again, at the center of the controversy in Florida is Governor Rick Scott. And he has not met directly, at least in the large crowds, with some of the students from the high school that they would like him to be there. They criticized him for not meeting with them in a large mass. However, he has met with several of them and several students from around the state, and also with lawmakers. And he has come up with a plan in which some of the things he wants to see changed in the state of Florida. So here are the this is the proposal made by Republican Governor Rick Scott. It's his gun proposal, and it's for the state of Florida to raise the age to buy guns to 21, or rifles and AR-15s, not just AR-15s or assault weapons. A ban on bump stocks, which became popular after the Las Vegas shooting. Pass a red flag law, which exists in the state of Florida, but he wants to beefen it up, where if someone feels that someone in their family may be acting irrationally or in an antisocial way, they can go to law enforcement and that person can be taken off the street or their gun can be taken away from them. He wants to spend $450 million to harden schools, which is something the president feels strongly about, and he wants to invest $50 million for mental health, increased mental health screening in the state of Florida. Now, again, as I've heard you may say for many, many years on this program, this does not have a single answer. It may be guns. It may be something else, but it may be mental health. It may be, in this particular case, I think we have a serious case of a law enforcement malfeasance malfeasance, I guess, or incompetence. So these are the things we're going to be talking about this evening. And Peter Hanna is one of our guests. Peter, nice to have you with us, making your maiden voyage.
Thanks for having me.
Your area of expertise is cybersecurity and intellectual property, and also you're with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois. As you look at this proposal by Governor Scott, a Republican who went against the NRA position, at least on a couple of issues, is this a good start?
So, I mean, I think, frankly, it's a start. I don't think it goes far enough to achieve or really move the needle on gun control in the United States. I think there's obviously a start, but a good start would be something that brings into the discussion universal background checks and outright bans on certain weapons that are of a particularly high level of danger and very high capacity magazines. But there's a menu of things that we could do to create a good start, and this is just a start.
Josh Cantor also joins us. You are the closest thing to a card-carrying Republican with us tonight. Josh, did Governor Scott just pick the low-hanging fruit, even though he did some things that some in his base, the NR base, may be upset with. Did he pick the easy targets, no pun intended?
Well, I think bump stocks is an easy target, but I think some of the things he did in terms of raising the age to 21 on all gun purchases is pretty significant. I would just say that if we think that we're going to solve this problem with guns alone, with gun control alone, it's just not going to happen. There are mental health problems. We live in a violent culture. We live in a culture where the family has broken down, and there are a lot of causes to
would
this.
Would you acknowledge, though, that thus far the anti-gun crowd or the gun control crowd, that so far they've been willing? They have mentioned mental health. They have mentioned background checks in addition to the predictable response that they've come out with in previous shootings.
They have, and that's good. But what they don't mention is that so many of these shooters grow up without fathers. In this case, Nicholas Cruz grew up without a father and a mother. And so that's a bigger,
broader issue that may not be able to be handled legislatively.
That's true, but there are social programs, I would argue, that have contributed to that problem.
Okay. John Stewart joins us. John is a libertarian.
Making my hat-trick appearance.
Right, and you were running for the Libertarian nomination for governor of Illinois.
That's correct.
So thanks very much for being with
us. Thank you for having me.
As a libertarian, what's your perspective on what Governor Scott has proposed, and is he going down the right road?
No, he's not. Raising the limit from to age limit from 21 to 18. What significance does that have to do with anything? Are you less mentally ill when you're 21 than if you're 18? Do you have less rage when you're 21 than you have 18? Banning the sale of bump stocks. I have an AR-15, unregistered, by the way. The only politician in America that boasts that I have unregistered weapons in my house. Mm-hmm. I won't be on any list for the government. A bump stock doesn't work.
Maybe they're after the show, John.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. a bump stock doesn't work. It's tactically useless.
Explain what it is to those that do not know.
Sure. Specifically with an AR-15, because that's the only experience that I have. The bump stock slips over the stock of the gun, and as you depress the trigger on my semi-automatic, you depress the trigger, one bullet will fire. What the bump stock does is basically push the trigger forward, and so you can almost like mimicking where you have to press, you're pressing the trigger multiple times, simulating a automatic weapon.
John, explain.
It's tactically, it's so hard to use, and it's cumbersome.
Explain to me and many people listening in the audience why anyone who is not in the military, assigned to a military function, responsibility, why does anyone need an AR-15?
Well, first of all, I like the look and the feel of it. I'm a hunter, and I use it for deer hunting. People laugh at that. I've shot 7 deer in 13 years with my AR-15. I am also
Let me ask you this.
Okay, go ahead.
If you could be convinced that by not giving that right to someone who might be mentally deranged, that you would give up the joy of hunting with your AR-15. Would you be willing to do it?
No, I wouldn't. But I am not.
Even if it saved lives.
I am not the person that thinks it behooves American society to put a gun in somebody who is mentally ill. Let's get that
across. Okay.
And I don't think any libertarian or any gun advocate thinks the same.
I haven't heard anybody
advocate for that. Then I'm glad we have that on the table.
I want to come back and get your reaction when we continue. 1-800-723-8029. Whichever side of the gun issue you're on, I want to expand it tonight to talk about mental health and some of these other issues. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us today.
This March, Goodman Theater artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theater, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Peter Hanna, you were going to make a point that you don't totally agree that mental health is the be-all and end-all that will solve this.
Yeah, that's right, Bruce. Mental health is an issue across the planet in all populations, really. But when you look at the two dozen populous Western countries, 80% of the gun-related violence occurs here in the United States. You know, that's that speaks to something much different than just a mental health problem. The number of firearm-related killings and mass shootings has tripled since 2011 here. So I think really what this focus on mental health does, it kind of deflects from the real question, which is, you know, what does the Second Amendment allow and what should lawmakers do? The Second Amendment, like any like the First Amendment, it's not an unlimited right. You know, I may have a right to speak my mind and express my views, but I can't yell fire in a crowded theater. I can't yell, you know, certain things in a workplace. So there are limitations. And the same for the Second Amendment.
You can't say certain words on television and radio.
That's exactly right. And the same goes for the Second Amendment. It's not an absolute and unlimited right. And it doesn't prohibit lawmakers from enacting meaningful legislation that actually takes down or reduces this epidemic that we have.
May I?
Go ahead, John.
What part of the Second Amendment of this right to bear arms is ambiguous or vague? I disagree with you. I bet we have the fundamental right to bear arms, and that has not did nothing to do with the militia. It was put there so that we have a well-regulated militia, in this amendment, and then also the citizens' rights to bear arms, regardless of the militia. I don't think that's ambiguous.
The citizens, John, don't have a right to carry machine guns. I mean, in the 1930s, Congress acted because the American people demanded action because of violence in the society, and saying these type of guns should be outlawed, and they have been. They've been outlawed since the 30s. So my question is, why is it wrong for this generation to look at one particular weapon and say exactly as the folks in 1934, hey, this thing has got to be banned? They're not
because we don't have automatic weapons legally sold in the state. We are now have semi-automatic and weapons that are now at the forefront. That's all that's left, that and handguns. So if you could tell me about having guns, the tyrannical government, this, that, and the other. There is a law right now where the United States government can incarcerate you if you're accused of being a terrorist without habeas corpus. So don't tell me that we shouldn't have guns because there's no such thing as a tyrannical government.
Josh, and then
it's specious.
So I want to go back to the mental health thing because I don't think that with this violent epidemic that we're experiencing that you can pinpoint any one single cause. But I do believe that mental health is a factor because we have 20% of kids 3 to 17 years of age in any given year have a mental or emotional illness. And the percentage of prison inmates with serious mental illness rose from less than 1% in 1880 to 21% in 2005. Now, look, I recognize that there is overdiagnosis and that there was probably underdiagnosis then. But clearly there is a mental health issue. But there's also the issue of violence in our society. There are violence video games.
You don't want anyone to be able to walk. If they have a mental health problem, you don't want them to be able to walk in and buy a gun, do you?
Of course not.
I don't think anybody in America wants that, Bruce.
Background checks on that.
And so why can't we get a vote just on that? Why would that be something that the NRA or their followers would oppose? Why?
I personally don't
oppose
it.
Only if you're mentally ill and in the NRA would you oppose that, in my view.
I agree with you.
Well, I say mentally ill with a violent background is something that I would oppose, yes. And I really don't care. As a libertarian, I don't care about the NRA. The NRA is there to protect the NRA, plain and simple.
Okay. Bruce, I can't speak for the NRA, obviously, or anyone but myself, but I can tell you that my thinking is that, there is in large part resistance to even that, simple action that everyone here at the table agrees to, because, going back to what John said, there is sometimes a bit of an absolutist view of the Second Amendment, which we heard, which is it's just the right to bear arms. I mean, that's obviously not the full language, which I pulled up here just so I have it.
And there's also an absolutist rhetoric
that's
used
exactly
by the left that says, okay,
yes.
they give gun owners every reason to concern themselves about whether confiscation is their real goal, because in many cases, it is their real goal, ultimately.
I mean, again,
the rhetoric feeds that.
I think there's extreme rhetoric, frankly, on all sides. That's unfortunately the death of nuance in American dialogue is, has been happening, unfolding for many years. But I'll say this. There is ambiguity in the jurisprudence surrounding the Second Amendment, but, the Supreme Court was very clear just a few years ago, that right's not unlimited. And in Heller, Justice Scalia, champion of the right and conservatives, wrote that that right is limited so that for arms that can be used for traditionally lawful purposes to protect your house, you know, to maintain the safety of your family and your home. It's not to pick up an AR-15 at a gun show, get an extended magazine, and, you know, use that to mow people down. There's no right for that, obviously.
In this particular case, insofar as what's in the court of public opinion, obviously, very quickly you had the gun control advocates move forward. I would say with rapid speed, those that think mental health is the issue and background checks and limiting access to people because of their age, that part of the debate moved fast. And then you had the revelation of the incompetence of the Broward County officials and officials throughout the state of Florida at a variety of levels and the FBI. And it seems to me that in many cases, that little debate, that's like 100% to zero in a debate, that has superseded the other issues as what people are talking about.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the incompetence?
That's the common denominator. Whether you want to take everybody's guns away, whether you're with the NRA, whatever it is, whether you're the President of the United States, you look at that. There's no debating that this was incompetence.
Systematic failure. Systematic failure by law enforcement
at the
and the administrators.
And federal level and the administrators across
absolutely.
The board.
Yes.
I mean, 39 instances where they could have stopped this guy. You have this coward outside the school that doesn't go in there, and he's sitting on the phone for 4 to 6 minutes. I'll be very interested to see what those phone records
right.
say and who he was
and
talking not, to.
And now we believe there may be three other Broward County deputies who were also sitting on the outside, based on the
right.
testimony of the sheriff's people from
and instead Pearl of taking Gables. Our rights away, why are we not, as a government, educating further school administrators, healthcare industry professionals, and law enforcement at the first initial warning signs of mental illness, so we could maybe stop this in the future and not stop
they
this
were
by
warned.
but not to take it seriously,
right?
And not to go to his house and arrest him in some kind of Salem, Massachusetts witch trial on hearsay, but to send over maybe a social worker. This is it might be something as simple as that, sending over a social worker just to do a brief incursion. Re-evaluation.
And having consequences for this guy who sat there and for the other people, the FBI,
he ought to go to jail
this guy
for
Scott
life.
Peterson, he's going to retire with a pension. He's already retired.
Ought to go to jail
he's going
to
get a pension. There ought to be consequences. Cut off this guy's pension.
Absolutely. Absolutely
Amen.
On that.
Amen.
Go ahead.
I would just say that the emphasis on the things that went wrong sort of it kind of you know moves the conversation in a different direction. I think, frankly, if everything had gone right and according to the existing law and according to plan, and this person hadn't shown signs and had gotten his gun legally, which I believe he did, we would still be in the same situation. There's no single, you know.
I think I would challenge that. We would be in the same situation as to what happened at that school?
Or well, no, I'm saying
in the same situation for what might happen in the future.
In the future. I'm saying ultimately under the current law, I mean, even if this person had, you know, checked all the boxes, stayed below all the radars, had not had written, you know, things on YouTube and elsewhere to indicate that he might be a threat, he could have still gotten this gun and done this sort of carnage just as easily.
You're right.
Well,
you can't stop violence. And the way to stop it was with a gun.
One recommendation was made by Governor Scott, which is the red flag law. And that is beefing up the Baker Law, which exists in the state of Florida.
Yeah.
The Baker Law is on the books there that says that local law enforcement can go in and they can interview and take a gun away from someone who has been reported as likely to perform some antisocial act. Now, that was not used. That was one of the 39, you know, points along this guy's trail that was missed. He wants to beef that up. Do you think that's a good idea, Josh? Should that be something that other states would explore?
That's for each state to decide, but it seems...
What do you think? What do you think of the idea?
I think the idea is logical. It seems logical to me.
So I make a claim against you because I'm mad at you because you're having an affair with my wife or something to that effect, why somebody would be mad at another man, and you send the police over to my house, and they could surreptitiously take my gun?
I don't know if it's surreptitiously.
That freaking scares the hell out of me.
Oh, let's find out. Now, Peter.
I'm just saying.
I don't know about that.
We have someone from the ACLU here.
Well, just to be clear, I'm actually not from the ACLU, but I'm a cooperating attorney. I'm the president of the Mexican Society. But when it comes to the gun, the Second Amendment conversation, you know, that's really, you know, my focus is really just my practice as an attorney and just my knowledge of the Second Amendment jurisprudence. But I can speak intelligently to this issue, and I'll say this. I mean, if he's sleeping with your wife, you can call the FBI right now and just say that you heard him, saying something that was potentially against the state. There's, you know, this law is not going to change that. What this law does.
My point is that he's mad enough to make an accusation on me, which sends the police over, which starts a chain of events.
But with or without this law.
And if I'm in a hostile state of mind, that the police officer can make a decision and surreptitiously take my guns? Where are we living?
Well, with or without this
Russia,
law, John.
Soviet Union?
With or without this law, John, I mean, I could walk out of here and call the FBI right now and say that you were, you know, plotting something on in the green room.
Understood.
You know, and that obviously you weren't. If anyone's listening, you weren't. But, you know, there's a lot of different vectors to do that sort of thing.
We're going to pause back shortly. 1-800-723-8289. I'm Bruce Dumont. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight. We have lots of callers on the line. Let's head to the great city of Boston, Massachusetts. Phil is listening to us on Sirius XM Satellite Radio tonight. Phil, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Phil.
Hey, I just wanted to speak real quick about the mental health industry. I hear a lot after the recent shooting of people saying this is a mental health issue, but the mental health industry is not very capable of handling this. I want to first say that I'm by no means an expert, but I do have a degree in behavior, and a lot of that is studying psychology. And the DSM, the manual that most mental health professionals use to diagnose people as a reference, there is no diagnosis for anger with society, for disillusionment and isolation. There is no clinical psychological issue that can diagnose that. And that's what a lot of these shooters seem to have, is that disillusionment. So when people say it's a mental health issue, yes, of course, there's something wrong with these people, but the industry is not capable of just locking these people away for anger and disillusionment.
Phil, let me ask you this follow-up. I talked about the Baker Act, okay, and some people said the Baker Act should have been exercised in the case of the Florida shooter. And I'm somewhat concerned with John's reservation is that people could be, you know, that they could be calling up the cops, trying to put somebody away for some, and maybe they, you know, were, you know, on the edge, but maybe the reason for them doing it could be punitive, there could be a jealousy issue involved. But what I'm thinking about, and I talked a lot about it last week, is for the parents out there, including the step-parents of the Florida shooter, where do they go if they believe their son has a problem? Now, in this particular case, they went somewhere, they said something, and nothing happened. That is inexcusable. That's one of the common denominators I think everybody can agree with on this issue. But there has to be some place where somebody goes, or maybe they're not taken off the street. Maybe their guns are not taken away from them. But there has to be a place for disillusioned young people and maybe disillusioned old people that they can go and they can get someone to listen to them. Because part of this is loneliness, and loneliness Amen. Needs to anger, and then there's the frustration. There's got to be somebody that can at least talk with people who are going through, you know, going through this boiling point in their life.
I agree, Bruce, and I think it's a great question, Phil, and it cuts to really the heart of this, because at the end of the day, if you're a person who's struggling with this, you know, you do have some outlets. You do have, obviously, healthcare outlets. You do have a, you know, society. You do have a social network, a familial network. But mental health issues are notoriously hard to diagnose, notoriously hard to identify. And frankly, this person who, you know, this hypothetical person who's going through loneliness and anger, if we put them in an environment where there is a ubiquitous amount of firearms everywhere, including incredibly lethal firearms that could kill dozens of people and have killed dozens of people, civilians in schools, children in schools, we create a pathway for them that makes it incredibly easy and sometimes tempting to go down that path rather than the path of getting help. So, you know, for me, growing up, I played violent video games. I watched violent movies. And you know what? Anyone who's been to high school in America knows there's a lot of folks who seem to be struggling with antisocial behaviors. But when you put them in a setting where guns are everywhere and powerful guns are everywhere, it becomes almost too easy for them to pick one up and act on
it. What Bruce is saying, though, is very valid. Is that it's not a cure; it's a firewall. It's let's stop and take a breather here with this person, where they can call
it's
the police department.
It's a friend.
Absolutely,
it's someone that's just going to listen to you.
Hi, my son. I think my son has some violent tendencies. I'm getting very worried, ma'am. Hold on 1 second. I'm going to put you with our county or our city social worker. Boom, clicks the button.
Right.
She gets transferred to somebody. That somebody takes down a cursor information about this person, makes a determination. I think that's somebody I need to pay a visit to.
Well, in this particular case, somebody made a determination that this guy did not need
systematic failure of the
but again,
of the
it, does, it doesn't mean the entire system failed.
Absolutely.
It meant that that case and that
that is correct.
Casework.
Well, what about the Las Vegas shooter?
If I may jump in here.
Go ahead, back to Phil. Go ahead, Phil.
If I may jump in here. Yes, of course, there needs to be a place for these people to go to get counseling, and there is in many cases, but that can only go so far. If I understand the Baker Act correctly, it requires a judge to certify that an actual psychiatric diagnosis has been made, that there is an actual psychiatric problem with the person in question, and then their
yes.
firearms can be taken away or
That's
they can
true.
Be institutionalized.
That's
but there's
true.
A limit to that because there has to be an actual diagnosis. And anger and disillusionment is not a diagnosis. And not every one of these shooters can have an actual diagnosis. I mean, look at the Las Vegas shooter.
That's
there
right.
was no known psychological or psychiatric illness with that shooter.
But there's nothing to stop. There's nothing to stop mental illness. With children or young people or even old people, you can have a firewall where there's a pause in this behavior. There's a pause in their thinking where possibly you could lead them to some mental health therapies. It's as simple as that. You're not going to stop. You're not going to stop mental disease.
Peter. No, I think Phil's point really stands out to me because, again, the Las Vegas shooter is a great example. You could have created every pathway you wanted, and he would have been able to lawfully slip through and get the weapons that he got and do the damage that he did.
In that situation,
Phil,
that's true.
Thanks, Phil.
But it strikes me that the Baker Act and that some the more things that you put into the system to try to stop these situations, the better. And, you know, Phil talked about leaning on family. Again, I'm going to go back to the fact that the family in America is falling apart and that 75% of poor kids in America now are growing up without a father. And that was in 1965, before Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs came into place, the number was the opposite. 75% of kids grew up with a father. And there's a lot of factors here.
Do we also have, when you're talking about following up on a young person's mental stability, don't we have HIPAA laws? Aren't they protected because of the HIPAA laws?
I mean, there are certainly privacy laws that ensure the protection of your health information, but in the setting of a court setting where there obviously Baker Acts play and there's a counselor who's there and they're before a judge, and obviously this presupposes that the individual has been, you know, potentially committed or will be committed. You know, obviously that's just there's
no. But if someone goes in to find out whether or not a student, because of
well, if the parent or if the parent or guardian goes first, I think that gives the HIPAA laws basically.
If it's a parent or guardian or a counselor or someone with whom obviously the individual has some privity or right, yeah. But I mean, I just want to go back to what Josh said. If we have an epidemic of vehicular deaths, let's go back to 1940 or 1950. Vehicular deaths are through the roof. We can't rely on, the family unit or, mental health or just hoping that people don't drink and drive. We had to legislate. We had to enact some meaningful limitations. We had to require people to wear seatbelts. We had to require people to go to jail if they drink and drive. I mean, and we have to start looking at this epidemic of gun violence. Again, I mean, this statistic, 80% of all firearm deaths in 2 dozen Western countries that are comparable to us are in America.
John, let me just respond. So we ought to take, because there's a societal breakdown at certain levels and people aren't doing their job and the family's breaking down and we have violent video games and all of these things that cause these situations, we ought to take away John's guns. He's a law-abiding citizen. He's got to pay the price. For this.
We have legislated this problem. 22,000 gun laws are on the books. We've legislated this.
Let's let Peter respond to Josh's question.
Okay. So it's a good point. It's a fair one. I don't want to take away John's guns. And frankly, I think if I tried, I'd be in trouble. So I personally don't want that on my back. But what I will say is this. There need to be. You say there's 22,000 laws?
Correct. When I ran for Congress in 2000, there was 22,000 gun laws in the United States. How did that stop any of these
problems? There could be 100,000, but if they're the wrong laws and they're not doing enough, they're not going the right way, then they're not worth it. From my perspective, Josh, really, it boils down to this. I don't want to take away his guns or anyone's guns, but there needs to be a more meaningful legal framework for gun control in this country.
Josh, question to you. You're a Republican supporter of the president. Does this issue represent an opportunity for the president to seize the higher ground and do things that those that despise the man would never believe he would do? Can he come so far? He's already indicated that he'd be willing to fight the NRA or disagrees with the NRA on a couple of points, including the bunch stocks, including the raising of the age. Do you think that he has the ability to be a profile and courage on this?
I think that he has a huge opportunity here. A huge opportunity.
All right, a question. All right, I agree with you. I agree with you.
I was going to get to you.
I was watching that meeting at the White House the other day, notwithstanding the note that said he should look interested or concerned. Yeah, to me, he was engaged with that. That was one of the most moving things I've seen any president do.
I agree with you.
You know where he lost me? And where as soon as he said the words, I knew the media was going to go in that direction. When he talked about arming teachers, he kept coming back to the hardening schools and arming teachers. And the reaction to that has not been positive at all.
I agree with you.
Instantly had the moral ground, and then I think he lost it.
He did a really good job during one of the meetings with the parents where he listened and he didn't talk a lot.
Yes.
He just listened.
And that was day two.
And then day two happened and he went off on this issue about arming teachers, which I think, frankly, is a terrible idea. And I say this as someone who supports the president. I think it's a terrible idea. He's got a real opportunity to get some of those moderate Republicans and independents back in his corner.
Women.
Suburban women.
Back shortly, 1-800-723-8289. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back, and we're going to go to Hudson, listening to us in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, listening to us on WRNN. And I'm going to ask my producer and engineer, who's hopefully listening, Sam, I'm going to ask Sam if we can conference this caller with a caller in Nashville. But let's give Hudson his opportunity, first of all, because he comes down on one side of the teachers with gun issue, and we got Rick in Nashville who comes down on the opposite side, and I'd like to put them together if we can. But Hudson, you go first. Why do you think it's a good idea in teachers having being armed with guns?
Well, I am a high school student, and right now with everything that's been going on, I don't feel safe in my own school. And I feel like if I was able to go to school knowing that there are teachers in the school who are able to carry firearms, I personally would just feel a lot safer at my own school.
And let me ask you, since you've identified yourself as a young man, what's your overall take on what happened in Florida? How can it be prevented? Is it just having someone in the school that has a gun, or are there bigger issues that you can weigh in on?
Well, I feel like just, you know, knowing that there are teachers in the school, maybe not necessarily knowing who those teachers are that are carrying firearms, you know, just kind of thinking about it from the other standpoint, like, I can't really put myself in the shoes of those people or the person who committed these horrible acts. But I don't know how someone could go into a school thinking about doing something horrible like that, knowing that there's, you know, a lot of people in that school who could potentially stop them.
Do you believe that school shooters are affected in any way by the gun-free zone and the gun-free zone signs that are on schools? Do they think about that at all when they're planning and plotting their dastardly antisocial acts?
Oh, well, no, probably not.
Yeah.
But I feel like the loss of life could probably be a lot less if, you know, it was stopped a little bit quicker.
Okay, Hudson, stay on the line. We're going to try something. We're going to see if we can conference you with Rick in Nashville. Okay, let's try it right now. Rick, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Hudson, are you still there? Hudson got dropped. Okay, let's go to Nashville. We tried to put them together. Because, Rick, you think that putting guns in teachers' hands is a dumb idea. Why?
Absolutely. I agree with you. I was with you. I was with the president until you said that, and I thought, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I've got 32 years experience law enforcement, retired sheriff's detective,
yeah.
And teachers are not hired be carrying guns and enforcing keeping the peace, right, in schools. You have to think of this scenario. You know, you've got an active shooter responding. Okay, say you do have armed teachers. Nobody knows who they are because your school resource officer might know them. I would think he would. But you're going to have other police agencies and officers storming into that building, and you're going to have – they're looking for civilians with weapons – and here comes a teacher coming out with a weapon, and it's just too volatile of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, teachers are chose teaching profession to teach children, to educate kids, not to be
right.
You know, it's a novel idea.
In
a perfect world, I guess it would work. But you've got to understand when these situations happen. I've seen police officers shoot at other police officers,
right,
in a panic situation.
Rick, let me ask you this question. Because as part of this sort of side conversation that the president began when reacting to someone that had suggested this idea, initially he said, well, either a teacher or a custodian or a football coach or somebody. Let me change the question. Should there be an armed, and by the way, I don't like the idea of school resource officer. That's to me like a glorified mall cop. I want him to be called either a sheriff or a deputy or some stronger name given to what he does. But my question,
right,
to you is, would you support the idea of having an armed respondent in every school, not a teacher?
Yes.
That's their job.
Yes.
All right, I'm going to go around the table.
You know,
I want to go right around the table, and then we're going to come back to you. Peter, would that be a good idea?
No, I don't think the solution to the problems we're facing are additional guns. And, you know, I think in the Florida case, there was someone there who was supposedly there to provide security, and that
incompetent
person didn't participate. I mean, this opens up. This really goes to how are we treating the symptoms. We now accept that school shootings are going to occur. They're going to happen. And now let's just add more guns to the situation. That's not what we should be looking at. We should be looking at the cause of these shootings, and we should be trying to take steps to keep guns out of schools entirely. The fact that
would you acknowledge though, in a real world that. The bigger, broader issues of whether it's systemic issues with violent games and movies and mental health background checks and debate over what type of weapons should be included in raising something to 21, that those are those are hard issues to resolve politically. And yet you have people that are demanding, even the president, they want their schools safer. Is this an easy step? It is not meant to be the answer. But is it part of the first step that you would do, and that is to secure the schools so that if somebody shows up there, they're not waiting 3 minutes for the cops to arrive?
I think we should be looking at meaningful steps. We've had this conversation every time there's a school shooting, and the only right first meaningful step is actually enacting laws to limit the sorts of weapons that are used in this.
Armed security guards and metal detectors.
We're out of time for this segment. To those callers on the line, stay right where you are. We're going to continue. In the next hour, we're going to broaden our discussion. We're going to be joined by Jonathan Morgan. He is an expert on cyber disinformation. We're going to be talking about the Russians, the bots, and the continued use of the bots in the wake of the Florida shooting. Back shortly with another hour on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont.
This March, Goodman Theatre Artistic Director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Featuring occasional injections of room in your window, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Peter Hanna, Josh Cantrell, John Stewart, and Jonathan Morgan. Our program tonight coming to you from our base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you'd like to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, radio and television, at beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in the next portion of our program, we're going to be joined by a special guest who will join with our in-studio guests in talking about the very important issue of Russia's involvement in our elections, starting in 2014, leading up to the presidential election last year. This was, of course, the basis of a 13-person indictment delivered by Robert Mueller last week against certain Russians and the disinformation campaign that they really brought into our body politic starting back in 2014. Since that time, because it talks about information that is disseminated to the American people that is false, it's fake. And sometimes they just want to create discord in the country. So there may be things that they're involved in that look like they may be pro-Trump or anti-Trump or pro-gun control or anti-gun control. And basically it's messing with the minds of the American people during a presidential campaign and perhaps even beyond. Joining us now is Jonathan Morgan. He is the founder and CEO of New Knowledge. And Jonathan, we thank you very much. You're joining us from Austin, Texas, and one of your areas of expertise is you protect companies from disinformation attacks and to defend public discourse, of which this program is an important part of public discourse. So we thank you for joining us tonight. And let me ask you a couple of really, really rudimentary questions from the get-go that some in the audience may not totally understand. In essence, what is a bot? What should people know about a bot? Who controls them, and how do you know if something is bot related?
So it's interesting because I think the term bot in the media anyway has become kind of a catch-all term for an account that's deceitful. And I think it's important if people who are kind of close to this work and do this sort of research think about it in a very specific way. So a bot is an account online on social media that is run by software. So it's not an account that's operated by a human being. It's an account that's basically driven by an algorithm. Sometimes they can be very sophisticated in the way that they imitate human beings. They can respond to certain types of messages under certain circumstances. They might even have a posting behavior that looks kind of human. It sort of is active at certain times of the day, inactive at other times of day, looks like it's sleeping, looks like it maybe has a specific type of political ideology, and often just is there to amplify a particular type of narrative. So that's what a bot is. A bot is driven by software. But I think it's important for listeners to know that when they hear that term thrown around, probably in most of the media, print media, broadcast media, kind of whenever this topic is discussed, sometimes journalists have a habit of interchanging the word bot to mean any account that is kind of not what it says that it is.
Okay. Obviously, within the last couple of weeks, the 13 Russians were indicted for their mischief starting back in 2014 in the American democratic process. Once those indictments came down, it's not like the mob when indictments come down. Sometimes they run to the corners and lay low for a while. Is there any question in your mind that the Russians, will they stop? Were they dissuaded by these indictments in any way?
It doesn't seem like it. And I think from the perspective of Russian operatives, why would you be dissuaded?
Right.
It's not as if they're not operating inside the United States. It's unlikely that they're going to be arrested. There's already been acknowledgement from the U.S. intelligence services that this type of attack took place, that they tried to interfere with our elections. This is kind of a known public issue. And so the campaign that they were operating has been discovered. It's sort of an open secret. And so the fact that specific Russian operatives were indicted, I think just speaks to the severity of the crime and the seriousness with which the Mueller investigation is taking that aspect of the investigation. But I think in practical terms, there's no way that it's going to disincentivize Russian operatives from trying to engage and manipulate our elections going forward. And if anything, given the success that they had in 2016, I would assume that they're emboldened, they and other groups who might want to manipulate our election are emboldened to do so in the future.
You mentioned, obviously, the elections and the indictments. My question to you is, when the school shooting happened in Parkland, Florida, What happened, in your view? You analyze this. You analyze what's going on the web and how it's being used and weaponized by one side or the other. What exactly did they do, and are they doing it at this very moment?
That's, I think, what's particularly, I guess, sort of worrisome about this problem is how complex the operation was that Russia engaged in kind of 2014, 2015, 2016. And I think also indicates the degree to which the platforms that we use to exchange information online are vulnerable, not just to Russia, but really anybody with an axe to grind or a political agenda who wants to influence public discussion. And so just looking back at the indictment that the Mueller investigation released, you know, about a week ago, they focused on a handful of fairly specific tactics. So kind of in the early days, there was a lot of intelligence gathering, a lot of listening to American political conversations, even certain Russian operatives visiting the United States and visiting certain areas of the country so that they could really learn how to authentically participate in these types of conversations. And then we saw them creating online personas, so kind of fake American social media profiles that represented sometimes individuals who became these kind of small-scale political pundits on Twitter and Facebook and other platforms. And then we also saw them create Facebook pages and other sort of fake organizations associated with one social cause or another, usually on both sides of the issue. So you'd see a page that looked like it was in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. And then you'd also see a Facebook page that looked like it was associated with a group of people who believed in border security. So there was a sort of a famous, infamous Facebook page called Securing Borders that was associated with this kind of Russian intelligence operation. And then what you'd see them do, in addition to posting inflammatory content, using the kind of advertising mechanisms on the different social media platforms to push that content in front of Americans, they'd also even stage live events. And so they'd stage an anti-immigrant protest with one group, and then they'd use a separate Facebook group to stage a counter-protest to the anti-immigrant protest.
Is there
and
any,
so you'd have real...
Is there any,
oh, go ahead.
Is there any way for someone who's looking to the internet to get their information, political information, is there any way for them to detect and to figure out which ones are legitimate public discourse and which ones are being manipulated by the Kremlin? Or Russians?
I think this is also why this is such a difficult issue. It's almost impossible for the casual observer to tell the difference as they're scrolling through their Facebook feed or they're scrolling through their Twitter feed to tell the difference between a legitimate account and a kind of manufactured account or a account that's misrepresenting itself. And I think that that's because of the way in which we use social media. There's really no way to verify and tell the difference between one and the other.
John, we've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029 if you want to join the conversation. When we come back, we'll hear from the guests in Chicago as well. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
This March, Goodman Theatre Artistic Director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theater, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Dumont back in Chicago, and we're talking via Skype tonight with Jonathan Morgan. He's joining us from Austin, Texas, where he hopefully listens to us on KLBJ every Sunday night. And guests around the table here in Chicago have questions for you, Jonathan. And Peter Dana, you have a question for Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Jonathan. And I was really interested in learning about new knowledge. So I wanted to ask you what, first, do you think that technology alone is enough to blunt this sort of constellation of threats from not just Russia, but from outside sources who want to, you know, impact our democracy and our voting process? And I guess the second part is, what can normal people do to, you know, spot the indicia that something is not what it seems when, you know, when we're on the internet, we see ads and everything else kind of blended together into a mix where it's really hard to discern what's an ad, what's legitimate, what's authentic.
Yeah, I think you're right. So, I mean, I think the degree to which technology is specifically the problem here, I actually think this is a different moment. I mean, the sorts of tactics that we're seeing are not new. There's actually an entire doctrine, sort of a psychological operations doctrine that most countries have in some manner, shape, or form for the kind of propaganda operations they've run in other countries to further their geopolitical agenda. So I think what we're seeing that's different now is that there's the kind of mechanics of these social media platforms and the volume of information that we now consume online, especially kind of in Western democracies, is so digitally focused. I think most of the news that most people consume, most of the socializing that most people do actually occurs online. And the way that the platforms are designed kind of segments us into different groups, and they kind of feed us the sort of thing that we like to read or like to consume because that's what keeps us using their platforms. And so they did it in a well-intentioned way to try and, you know, make us happy and keep us using the site and click on more ads. But the byproduct of that, or the unintended consequence of that, was that it ended up giving us very homogenous information, sort of closed information spaces where the type of people with whom we interact are relatively similar, and the type of information we get is relatively similar. And that creates an environment that makes it really easy for an outsider to manipulate it.
Mm-hmm. Should we be demanding more from Facebook and Twitter and Google and all of these companies? And if so, what should we be demanding from them?
I think we can demand greater transparency at the start. I think the social media companies, to their credit, are now taking this problem very seriously. I think the reason that they've come under fire is that it took them 2, 3, 4, 5 years of outside researchers, the intelligence community, sort of different legislators trying to flag this issue for them and indicate to them that it was important. And so now that there's a lot of public outcry, they finally sort of succumb to the pressure and I think are trying to find ways to clean up the discourse on their platform. But this raises a new issue. How are they going to do that? We've basically put the power of, or the kind of the definition of free speech or the implementation of our free speech policies in the hands of a relatively small number of technology executives and program and product designers. So now Facebook and Twitter and Google are in the, I think, awkward position for them about deciding what is and isn't acceptable when you're talking about public discourse, which is kind of a strange new frontier. So I think the kind of transparency that they need to implement in order for this kind of next generation of social media technology to be effective is incredibly important. Like, we should know what is and isn't allowed on their platform, how they make decisions about what content is and isn't okay, about what sorts of behavior is okay. That should be part of the public discussion.
Josh Cantrell has a question for you.
Jonathan, I'm a cybersecurity lawyer who has defended companies in cybersecurity cases for the last 12 years. And in a number of those cases, Russia has been involved. It's been well known, at least in the corporate world, about Russia and China and former Soviet bloc countries. Was there more that the Obama administration should have done to prevent or mitigate the extent that Russia interfered in our elections? And is there more that the Trump administration should be doing now?
I think it's true in both cases. I think that's actually probably the most frustrating part about this particular experience with Russia meddling in the 2016 elections is that the capability of Russia to engage in this type of attack was understood in 2014, 2015, sort of already being discussed internally at the NSC, the National Security Council, which is the kind of security arm of the Obama or the current presidential administration. And I think the fact that we had seen other groups engage in these types of tactics before. So I think what a lot of national security experts and social media experts recognized when ISIS manipulated our platforms to further their agenda as terrorists and to put their propaganda into the mainstream is that the mechanics of social media that they were exploiting or they were subverting, anybody could do that. And a country that had significantly greater resources would be able to exploit them to a much greater degree. So instead of dominating our news cycle, you could, in fact, perhaps undermine the integrity of an election. And I think the Obama administration didn't act quickly enough in spite of some best efforts. And I think the Trump administration is also slow to recognize the importance of solving this problem. So I think we're still vulnerable in 2018.
And where would you put North Korea and China or other adversaries of the United States. I mean, all the focus has been on the Russians, but I can't imagine that the minds in North Korea and China are sitting silently by and watching this just happen.
Well, I think China in particular has a similar capability. There are sort of well-documented examples of the Chinese government basically using social media platforms within China to do domestic propaganda focused on their own population. And I think the fact that they've developed that capability means they could almost certainly deploy it in another country like the United States. But I think even beyond these kind of sort of well-coordinated, highly sophisticated state actors like Russia and China, this type of manipulation is fairly easy to conduct at a small scale, even by relatively unsophisticated actors. So domestic political groups almost certainly will try this kind of thing in 2018. People with kind of an axe to grind for some culture wars issue or another, who are not necessarily interested in electoral politics, will be orchestrating these types of campaigns. And I think the bar is so low and the cost is so low that if you don't have grand ambitions of undermining an election, but rather just kind of manipulating a much smaller segment of the population, it's actually fairly straightforward and very effective.
John Stewart's got a question.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you? Thanks for being on the show. Former CIA Director James Woosley said just recently that, and has admitted, that the United States has tampered with, for years, with foreign elections. I know from being a historian myself that the United States and the CIA has backed countless coups in Northeast Asia, from Vietnam to South America. I'm taking a libertary stance on all of this. Isn't this kind of part of doing the business in the internet age and the global world? And aren't we suffering blowback from all of the malfeasance that our government has done for the past 50 or 60 years?
I think you make an interesting point that the United States has engaged in this type of activity in the past. But to me, those are two separate questions. Whether or not that should be part of the U.S. policy to engage in this type of activity in trying to shape the discourse in other countries or trying to shape the electoral process in other countries is I think, an important policy question. But I think here we're also talking about whether or not other countries should be allowed to do that to us, or whether we have the appropriate defenses in place to stop that kind of interference in our elections.
I don't think anyone would disagree that the United States needs to continually step up and spend more money and get a tighter grip on our security, especially with our election machines. I just read an article how a couple of professors were still at this point in 2018 able to break in to election and voting systems. So that's obviously a concern. But I don't know. I just think that we are suffering finally blowback from years of United States tampering with many countries.
Let me ask one quick follow-up on that. In the indictments, it was made, Rod Rosenstein said, that there was no, it didn't affect the outcome of the election. Well, we do know that there were efforts to break into the Secretary of State and the voting records in several 21 states. I don't believe that will stop. So I guess the question is, someone, as you're looking forward to what's next, isn't that the next logical step, is to expand their disinformation, but to literally go to the heart of voting machines in the United States on a state-by-state basis?
I think that will absolutely be a target, especially because these voting systems are outdated in terms of sort of the cybersecurity infrastructure that would be required to ensure the integrity of these electronic voting systems has been proven again and again, like was just mentioned by one of your panelists in the studio. It is just not sufficient to defend itself against these types of attacks. So I think they're absolutely a target, and I think that's an area that we should closely monitor in 2018, in addition to the kind of public discourse interference that we saw in 2016.
Peter's got a follow-up question for you.
Yeah, and I had one follow-on for Josh's question and the discussion he had with Jonathan, which is, you know, the 2013 State of the Union, then President Obama announced that there was going to be an effort to improve the critical cybersecurity infrastructure in the United States, and that led to the establishment of the 2014 cybersecurity framework, the NIST framework, which was really based on a year or more of input from more than 1,000 private organizations to talk about how they could actually fix their cybersecurity problems and establish a framework for improving cybersecurity on an ongoing basis. So compare that to, you know, President Trump, who persists in denying that these hacking and cybersecurity attacks across the country had any impact on the election. So I think really the question that was asked, which is could President Obama have done more, could President Trump have done more? I think every president could do more and could have done more, but there's definitely a contrast there.
Jonathan, I've got to pause. Can you stick with us for another segment?
Sure thing.
Okay, back shortly. 1-800-723-8029. Talking to Jonathan Morgan and our guests in the studio about cybersecurity and now protecting the ballot for 2018 and beyond. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. I want to ask, we're talking with Jonathan Morgan, who's joining us live from Austin, Texas, who is an expert in the area of cyber disinformation and cybersecurity. A question I want to ask you, it's a little far afield, but since the Russians have been able to pinpoint certain messages that they want the American people to see, I think most people would agree that the most successful thing on the Internet is pornography. And we know that Russians and the former Eastern Bloc are very involved in the pornography industry worldwide. What can you tell us, if anything, about the role of pornography in an attempt by the Russian government or Russian billionaires to use that to gather information on the sexual interests of Americans because they know who click on their sites?
Well, I can't speak to any specific, campaigns or operations that are geared specifically towards understanding American consumption of pornography. However, I think it is worth pointing out that a lot of the tactics that are being used to kind of, you know, jam a particular message into the mainstream kind of co-opt narratives, or almost like sneak the content that you want into the places where the people who you're trying to target will see it. A lot of that is known generally as kind of black hat marketing techniques. So kind of things that a mainstream company wouldn't do, but things that companies that didn't need to worry about their reputation, ways in which they might try and manipulate social media to kind of force the content that they want to be more broadly disseminated. And so it's hard to know whether or not they targeted sort of pornographic content in particular. These tactics do come up a lot in the kind of shady spaces on the internet that are kind of 1 or 2 degrees removed from the mainstream.
It has been said that this did not affect the election, at least in the indictment. Rod Rosenstein said that what they know now, it didn't affect the outcome of the election. But my question to you is, if they have this sophisticated capability, and you look at states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio, the results there were a surprise to the Democrats and certainly a surprise to the Republicans as well. It seems to me that that's a very short leap of belief that they would not have known exactly what to do in those three states to flip those states from a blue state to a red state.
I think the idea that this didn't impact the election, it's an interesting statement to make, because I think for that to be true, then I think you'd also have to accept that the conversations that we have online, the way in which we kind of engage with each other on the internet, the kind of water cooler conversations that have moved on to Twitter and Facebook and other social media are pointless. And if that's true, I think that that would be kind of alarming. I think particularly to the social media companies that have made a lot of money selling advertising to people who are having conversations on those platforms. Kind of the whole idea is that you're able to persuade people to take some type of action, whether it's to go buy a product or to attend an event or whatever. And I think what we did see is that it was possible to inflame the passions of Americans, to get them to go and sometimes demonstrate in the thousands based on material that was totally invented and totally fake. And so I think the idea that this didn't impact election outcomes at all, it's hard to swallow. I think that anything that operates at this scale and has this much influence over public discord that's put in front of millions and millions of Americans, this sort of activity that we engage in online is either pointless or it impacts our behavior.
Yeah,
and if you believe that it impacts our behavior, then I think it impacts our politics.
Yeah, I think I've stated, you know, since Election Day is that, I'm looking for the evidence. And certainly in the last couple of weeks when the indictments have come down, it should raise everyone's antenna about what really may be going on then and now in the country. That's why I think it's an important issue to discuss. But again, we really don't know. No one will be able to prove how, you know, whether people's minds were changed because of something they read that might have been put into the internet waters in thought process by the Russians. And certainly you don't need a lot of votes to change either in Michigan or Wisconsin. Those are the two primary states that are being focused on here. Because I guess if somebody could prove to me that there was a memo cooked up by the Russians that told Hillary Clinton that she didn't have to campaign in Michigan again, I would say that to me is a smoking gun. But a reality is that she collapsed. Video existed of her collapsing on September 11th, and you can't tell me that collapse of her did not affect votes in favor of Donald Trump and against Hillary Clinton. And that's something that's real, but it would be interesting to know, going back, how much the Russians were involved in disseminating that devastating piece of political video.
You make a really good point. I think it's difficult to isolate and say how much this might have impacted the election. But I think it's also important to remember that whether or not seeing an ad changed anybody's mind or kind of flipped their vote, like if they were going to vote for one candidate and they saw enough Russian ads for Donald Trump and they decided to vote for him instead of Hillary Clinton, is perhaps not the whole story. I think the specific agenda, as outlined in the kind of Mueller indictment, was that it was a voter suppression campaign. So that there's sort of a consistent onslaught of negative ads and negative material targeted at, in this case, Clinton supporters about whatever. She's a criminal. She's part of a global conspiracy. She can't be trusted. She conducted shady business at the State Department. Mm-hmm. We need to see her emails, kind of on and on and on. And those messages ultimately, I guess the question that we need to ask is how many people didn't vote who might have otherwise because they were underwhelmed with the candidate who was kind of a member of the party that they usually vote for.
Josh has
I think it's
go ahead.
Slightly more subtle effect.
Yeah, okay.
So, Jonathan, I agree with you. I mean, we've got to get to the bottom of this, and I agree with Peter that that I'm disappointed in the Trump administration's, or not the administration, but in President Trump's refusal to accept that Russia interfered. But I think that we also have to keep this in focus. Hillary Clinton made the decision, even though she lost Wisconsin to Bernie Sanders, to not campaign there at all. She made the decision to only barely campaign in Michigan and to go, when she did go into Michigan, into Detroit and not into the Upper Peninsula and the rest of the state where she got killed. So I think this has got to be looked at in a global context. And I hope that at the end of it, we can also go back and look at some of the Obama administration's failures on the cybersecurity front, which have been criticized by folks in his own administration, including General Keith Alexander, the former director of the NSA and head of the U.S. Cyber Command, who said in 2012 that economic espionage, mostly by China, had led to the largest transfer of wealth in human history. The OPM Office of Personnel Management hack, which led to 22 million current and former federal employees' information being out there, and of course Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden.
Okay, I want to go to take a call. Let's go to Mark listening to us in Norfolk, Virginia, on Sirius XM Radio. Go ahead, Mark.
Hey, good evening to you and your guests. Look, I coming from a journalism background, one of my things I just get so worn out hearing, and the truth really hasn't really been told far as any type of timeline, and hoping your guests can share some light on it, is the Steele dossier. And the Steele dossier was actually initiated by the Republicans that were in the primary trying to dig up some opposition research on now President Trump. And so I just wanted to ask your guests, how maybe in detail did he know, how far along was that Steele dossier at the time that the Republicans stopped funding it and that the Democrats and Hillary Clinton started funding it? Was it 50% done? Was it 60% done? I was just curious. I never heard the answer to that.
I don't know whether anybody at the table would know that answer, but I do want to ask a question to Jonathan and sort of tie it into what we've been talking about with Jonathan, and that is the role of the dossier. Do we know how much time and effort and money the Russians have used in moving the initial report of the dossier and anything about the dossier? Are they involved, the fanning of the flames on this very this issue that's separating a lot of Americans?
There is evidence that Russian-linked accounts were amplifying the dossier, but also trying to knock it down. And I think this is actually a really common situation where we were seeing activity on both sides of any divisive issue. Because at the end of the day, as much as this is framed in the context of electoral politics, and we're very interested in whether or not Russia undermined the elections, there's a larger agenda here, and that's ultimately to sow discord amongst Americans and get them fighting with each other. So if they can find us.
If their goal is discord, how can we have serious discussions like this program? How can we have discussions when there are legitimate sides that differ with each other? Does that in itself promote discord?
I actually think that that programs like this, journalism that actually has more than 140 or 280 characters to make its point, institutions that have a reputation for trying to be factual and accurate and methodical in their reporting over many years, these are the places where we can have substantive discourse about the issues, as opposed to inflammatory, incendiary, clickbait, sort of misleading information that spreads like wildfire on social media. I think there is a way to have meaningful discourse, but I'm not sure that we're doing it sort of in these kind of bite-sized social media packages.
Jonathan, we've got to move on right now, but I want to invite you. We hope to have you back on this program again in the future. You were the founder and CEO of New Knowledge, a company that is looking at disinformation on the Internet with the Russian fingerprints all over it. We thank you very much for sharing your knowledge tonight, and hopefully we can have you back sometime in the future. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Back in Chicago, and during the break, Peter was making a point to extend the conversation we've had about security and disinformation. You were talking about another huge issue that we should probably do several shows on. That is just big data. How much big data is out there, and how much they know about each and every one of us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean we trust lots of organizations with our data, social media, you know, our phones, everything else. And, you know, there's sort of we humans are very tactile, and we don't perceive data the same way that we perceive, you know, an item, a cup, So it's very hard to see that the breadcrumb trail of data that we leave across the internet. You know, with the death of net neutrality, with the repeal of net neutrality and the repeal of privacy laws that prevented, internet service providers from tracking everything that you do on the internet, you know, we have just sort of opened the floodgates really to providing more of our data to third parties who incidentally happen to be the parties who can, without net neutrality, control, you know, the flow of that data back to us.
Is that a result of this current generation, this younger generation, that literally they put all their secrets on the internet, they send pictures of half the things they do, and are they part of the problem here? That they can't keep a secret, and there's no reason for the government to ask them too many questions because they've volunteered them all.
I think there's definitely a cultural element to sharing or oversharing on the internet, but that's really why the government needs to do something. I mean, I can tell you that in Illinois, there's HB House Bill 4819, which would restore net neutrality in Illinois. People think of net neutrality as just something that's a consumer issue, you know, how much am I going to have to pay for my internet? But it's actually a much larger issue, and when combined with the privacy issues that we've heard of, you know, if you give someone or give a third party enough information about you, and then you give them the ability to control the speed at which certain things come to you, the ability to prioritize advertising, you know, in a way that doesn't give you the best results but gives you the best results for a bottom line, you end up kind of creating a perfect storm for those overshares.
About Ancestry.com.
Well, not to pick on any particular company, but we, you know,
a lot of them are doing it.
A lot of companies, will do genetic analysis, and I'd be interested in knowing how many people who, you know, provide their DNA, you know, read carefully all the terms of service and all the privacy terms that are in those.
I didn't.
Yeah, so maybe after the show you could give them a read.
And they're also asking me questions about this and my father, what did he die of, and my mother, what did he die of. I mean, it's an ongoing series of questions about your medical background, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that's all going to pop up when some, you know, pharmaceutical company is going to send me something for my diabetes. John?
Yeah, throughout the campaign trail, I've talked to numerous seniors, but one of the demographic groups I've spoken with are millennials. And it is a little bit alarming, and I've tried to educate them as best I can in the past year of running for governor, is that there are seemingly, in my opinion, and I think a lot of other people, they're not that concerned with, you know, giving their information and trading their security to some degree, their electronic and cyber breadcrumb trail, as long as it lets them, you know, chat with other people and garner information, whether it's from a clothes store opening up or what new restaurant down the street has a 5-star Yelp rating. And that, to me, as a libertarian and as a father and as a 51-year-old man, is quite alarming. And I think that's something that we need to discuss with our young, you know, with our children, our younger generation who have grown up with the internet.
John, I want to ask you, we have a few minutes left, sure. But I want to ask you, I introduced you. You are running for the nomination for governor of the Libertarian Party in the state of Illinois.
That is correct.
Why do you want to be governor?
Well, because I'm very upset. I'm a small business owner and I'm a father, and everything that I am upset about and that is going wrong with this state systematically affects my life. Everything from real estate taxes, I own commercial and residential real estate, the educational system where the teachers' pensions and salaries are going up, but the reading and math scores are not exponentially going up with the salaries. And the state that is basically bankrupt and $250 billion in pension payments going into 2047. This is unsustainable. The five pension systems, the Chicago Police and Fire, they are in a death spiral. They are being lied to. I know for a fact that we are going to have a congressperson from this state trying to enact a law, put it through Congress to let states go bankrupt. Once this state goes bankrupt, the pensions are going to go bye-bye, and I am trying not to let that happen.
What does the Libertarian Party of Illinois need to do to stay on the ballot as a viable ballot position for elections down the road.
Sure. Well, we need major party status, and to get that, we in short term,
we need
5% of the general election vote.
And if that happens,
and if that happens, then we no longer need to have the basically three times the amount of votes that the Republicans and Democrats get. People don't understand. A Democrat or Republican running for Congress, he needs to turn in 1,500 votes. A third party candidate like a Libertarian
petitions
needs to turn in 7,500 to 10,000 votes. It is ridiculous, and it is the systematic duopoly.
You mean
that
votes
is ruining,
or signatures?
Signatures. To get ballot access. So we are forced to get three times the amount of signatures than a Democrat or Republican. That's just not the American way.
And as if you get the nomination,
right,
you don't expect you're going to win, do you?
I think there's a very good chance to win, for the simple fact is you have two billionaires, and then you have this experienced politician and small business owner myself. I think the people of Illinois are going to show Rauner and Pritzker that money can't buy you love. And it's not going to buy you the state of Illinois.
You're going to snake through the billionaires.
I truly believe that, yes.
All right. John Stewart, thanks very much for joining us this evening. Peter Dennett, thank you very much. And your maiden voyage, Josh Cantrell, thank you very much. And Jonathan Morgan, we thank him as well. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WIND Radio. Our thanks to Fritz Goldman and Sam Greenberg and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
This March, Goodman Theatre Artistic Director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays, and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com.